Kandaraka Sutta, Majjhima 51, one of the rare suttas which has no Chinese or Sanskrit counterparts. However, much of the material found in it is found elsewhere in different suttas. As usual, we distinguish between two notions. One notion is of a counterpart sutta, is where you have more or less a complete text which has an equivalent in a different language. But then, of course, you have corresponding passages from the different suttas, which also may be common. So something like the jhana formula, okay? You have the formula for the four jhanas or the four satipatthanas that appears in countless suttas. But of course the boundary line between those two things seems intuitively obvious, but it's one of those things where you start to actually settle it in detail, it becomes not quite so obvious, so sometimes it's not easy to tell which one is a counterpart sutta and which one isn't. So, anyway, here is the Kandaraka Sutta, set in Champa, and Champa being a region slightly to the south and mainly to the east of Magadha. So here we have the main Buddhist region. In ancient India, and the Ganges River. Gaya is where Venerable Tipasi and I are going in a few weeks' time. Magadha, Rajagaha, and next door to that Nalanda, Pataliputta, and then up here the Vajjin Republic, Vesali and so on. It's up here, and so this is the route that the Buddha took in his last journey, was up through these regions here. He was born in Kapalavattu, spent most of his time in Sarvatti, and taught the first sermon in Sarnath. So you can see that most of the early Buddhist stuff happened in this very, very small area here. Well, it looks like a very small area, of course. India is big, right? So it's not that small, but it, relatively speaking, it's still quite a limited area. And then occasionally he went out to further places. So occasionally we hear of him up at the Kurukshetra, Kuru country, the Satipatthana Sutta and other places. He also made his way down this way some way. And here we find him at Champa, to the east. Anga, one of the great kingdoms later absorbed by the empire of King Ashoka. So this is more or less kind of mountainous desert area here. It's difficult to get through, so the southern route sort of went down here. But there's one reference in the suttas to one of the rivers down here. Godavari is what it is, Godavari. But apart from that, all of the suttas took place more or less in this area. That's what I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Champa, on the banks of the Gagara Lake, with a large sangha of bhikkhus. Then Pesa, the elephant driver's son, and Kandaraka, the wanderer, went to the Blessed One. Pesa, after paying homage to the Blessed One, sat down at one side, while Kandaraka exchanged greetings with the Blessed One, and when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he stood at one side. Standing there, he surveyed the sangha of bhikkhus sitting in complete silence, and then he said to the Blessed One, "It's wonderful, Master Gotama, it is marvelous how the sangha of bhikkhus has been led to practice the right way by the Blessed One." So this phrase is wonderful, it's marvelous. Acharyang bho Gotama, abhutang bho Gotama. Okay? And this, of course, being a class of scriptures, the early scriptures, Acharya Dhamma or Acharya Buddha Dhamma, or the Buddha Dhamma, signifies this is in that class. So when you say something's marvelous, it's amazing, it's incredible, you say, Acharyang bho Gotama, abhutang bho Gotama. Abhutang, the root of that is not particularly clear, but the root may be from bhu to be, in which case it would literally mean unreal. It's unreal, Gotama. I suggested to Bhikkhu Bodhi once he used that as his translation, but he didn't take me up on that. Those who are blessed ones, accomplished and fully enlightened in the past, at most only led the sangha of bhikkhus to practice the right way as is done by Master Gotama now. And those who will be blessed ones, accomplished and fully enlightened in the future, at most will only lead the Sangha of Bhikkhus to practice in the right way as he's done by Master Gotama now. And Buddha replied, so it is, Kandaraka, so it is. Evametang Kandaraka, evametang Kandaraka. And Kandaraka, in this Sangha of Bhikkhus, there are Bhikkhus who are arahants, with taints destroyed, who have lived the holy life. So Bhikkhu Bodhi renders with taints destroyed. Now, I've remarked on this before, but I'll just remark on it again. I don't really like that translation very much. Kirna doesn't mean destroyed. It means wasted away, used up, evaporated, dried up, something like that. Okay? Doesn't mean destroyed. And asava, taints is not very good for asava. I don't know what else is good. This problem is defilements, perhaps, is what I'm using these days for asava. Who've lived the holy life, have done what had to be done, have laid down the burden, reached their true goal. Okay, so here Bhikkhu Bodhi is translated as the true goal, anuppatta sadattha. And has reached anuppatta, and this word here, sadattha, the prefix sa in Pali stands for, it can stand for a number of different things. One of the things it stands for is swa in Sanskrit, swa meaning own, okay? But it also can stand for things like sang and so on, which is translated here as real. So one way of translating it is the true goal or the real goal, or the other way of rendering it, that would be one's own goal. Okay? So it's the same as in the word sadhamma, which we meet very often. This also is the meaning of the prefix is could be interpreted another way. Another one is sambuddha, which again is interpreted as a self-awakened sometimes, or fully awakened, or something like that. But these are words which sometimes are ambiguous in Pali. So there's no one right translation. Parikirna bhava sangyojana, who have destroyed the fetters of being or have worn away. Parikirna, again this word kirna. We chanted it in the Ratna Sutta last night. Kirnang puranang. Samadanya vimutta, and liberated through right knowledge. So in this Sangha, there are sekhas, there are bhikkhus who are sekhas, so who are training, of constant virtue, santata sila, santata constant, santata vuttino, living a life of constant virtue, sagacious, living a life of constant sagacity. Now the word sagacity is not one which trips off the tongue in a modern English idiom. Nipaka, I don't think Nipaka means sagacious anyway. He's translated in according with the commentary, which means Nipaka means wise, but actually, if you see how it's used here, it's in close connection with Sila, okay? And that's quite typical, and coming after Sila, like if you look in the way the gradual training is presented, what comes after sila is often things like sense restraint as an advanced aspect of sila. And in fact, if you look at how it's presented in the suttas, often it seems to mean something like controlled or guarded or restrained or something like that. I think that's probably what the meaning is here. It seems to be the Sanskrit meaning as well. They abide with their minds well established in the four foundations of mindfulness. As always, and notice that the satipatthana is accompanied by the verb upatthita citta. So here upatthita is the verbal form, and this is a past participle. So the citta, their mind, is well, su, upatthita, established. And so that's the verbal form upatthita, which we find here in a noun form in the compound satipatthana. But notice how in the Pali the u is dropped, so it's supantita, actually has a U there, and that U is dropped in the Pali, but it's found in the Sanskrit version, Smrityupasthana. And so this is again quite characteristic of Pali, that when you put words together in compounds, if there's a vowel at the start of the compound, like a little U there, that it often gets dropped off and you can't see it in the resulting compound. In other words, what's happening here is the word sati is being used with upatthana twice. One's well established on the establishings of mindfulness, something like that, which is a kind of idiom which you don't really find in English all that much, but very common in Pali. So, of course, here still Bhikkhu Bodhi is using for foundations of mindfulness as in accordance with Nyanamoli's original translation, but in later translations he's rendered it establishings of mindfulness. After his various wrong doctrines on this matter were refuted by a certain bhikkhu. Okay, I really hope that Bhikkhu Bodhi doesn't listen to this. If you do, hello, Bhikkhu. Here, what for? Here, a bhikkhu abides contemplating a body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating feelings and feelings, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating mind as mind, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating dhammas as dhammas, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. So here the standard satipatthana parikapi, meaning a textual bit, which is cut and pasted into lots of suttas. If Mel was here, she'd be able to correct my Latin. And so we've been over this particular formula in some detail on several occasions, so I won't go into it in too much detail, but just to refresh your mind, and for those of you who weren't here earlier, here we have contemplates the body as a body, kaya kayanupasti. So what the meaning of this is, I think the meaning is, when it says kaya, it repeats kaya kayanupasti, it has a number of different implications. One implication is simply emphasis, okay, you're just being a bit more emphatic. But more specifically, when it actually talks about that in the Anapanasati Sutta, what it says is the breath is a certain body among the bodies, okay? In other words, you have this physical body here, and part of that is the breath, yeah? So when you say kaya kayanupasi, you're contemplating on an aspect of the body, or a certain dimension, or a certain way of looking at the body, okay? So this is what this idiom means. Anupasi, pasi means to see, observe. Anu is along, so we translate in English as contemplation. So something like sustained observation. And the word anupasi here is very close in meaning, probably identical in meaning with vichara, as the jhana factor of vichara. In fact, the jhana factor of vichara is glossed by the word anupekkhanata in the Abhidhamma, which is anu and pekkha, meaning the same thing as pasi. So they're probably the same meaning. One dwells. That means one abides doing these things. So that kind of idiom basically means one meditates in Pali. So one's abiding. Atapi. That's what we were doing last night. Right? Staying up till midnight, just pushing on through. Atapi. Just going for it. Burning up the defilements with the fervour of your relentless devotion to meditation. Sampajanya, of course, this is being the wisdom aspect, and sampajanya generally meaning something like contextual understanding. So this is like that kind of reflective ability to know what you're doing while you're doing it, basically. So this is sampajanya. So you're aware in your meditation, you know what you're doing, you understand how this meditation is going. Satima, one has mindfulness. And I'd just like to add here as a note, a cry of frustration and despair in the wilderness of those who care about correct Pali grammatical declensions, okay, where I feel very lonely. And satima is actually a masculine form. So whenever you meet a nun called satima, of which there are several, then you should say Venerable Sir to her. This is not a feminine form, it's a masculine form, and the masculine forms are frequently found with a long A ending. And the feminine form would be something like Satimanti or something like that. Okay, so it means one has mindfulness, which means one is recollecting oneself into the present moment. Okay, so you're sustaining and bringing up that sense of awareness and application of the mind into the meditation object repeatedly and continually. Vinaya loke, vinaya, having got rid of. This is the same root as the word vinaya we use, but this is vinaya, having got rid of, for the world, okay? Loke, for the world, or in the world, regarding the world. Abhijja domana sang. And this being something like, abhijja is greed or lust or something like that. And domanasa here means something like ill will. This phrase is actually very closely related, and this was originally pointed out by Venerable Brahmali, that phrase is very close to the phrase that's used in the context of sense restraint, that by doing sense restraint one is able to not be overwhelmed by abhijja domanasa for the world. And so probably this means, what this refers to is like a preliminary lessening and dampening of defilements, greed and hatred, as a result of completing the early stages of the path, particularly that of sense restraint. Okay, and so through doing these things, one's able to calm and cool down the mind to a certain extent. Abhijja is used typically in the sense of fairly strong lust. Okay. So, you know, and we translated covetousness, and it's actually described in exactly that term. So, like, a strong wish, that I might have an iPod that's as good as my neighbor's or something like that, you know. This is covetousness. So it doesn't necessarily mean completely having got rid of all the hindrances, but more that it's dampened and reduced the hindrances enough so that you can get on with your meditation practice. Vedanasu, and then feelings. Contemplate a feeling in the feelings. And again, probably a similar meaning is that, you know, it's described in terms of pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, and neutral feeling, and so on. So you're looking at and regarding those feelings. Citta. And again, this is described in terms of many different kinds of or aspects of the mind with lust, without lust, with hatred, without hatred, and so on and so forth. But the difference with the mind is, of course, the mind is the knowing. So here, you're actually looking at, like, what is the nature of consciousness. So rather than looking at the actual greed or hatred itself, you're looking at the mind that has that in it. Okay, this is a very subtle distinction. Okay, so the first half of it, the way it's described, is describing the mind with and without various kinds of defilements. The second half is describing the mind in and out of various kinds of samadhi attainments, the concentrated mind, the freed mind, the unexcelled mind, and so on and so forth. So samadhi is a very important part, especially of cittanupassana. And also vedananupassana is also mentioned, but especially cittanupassana. And dhammesu dhammanupassi, Bhikkhu Bodhi is translated as mind objects, which I think is certainly incorrect. And dhamma here doesn't mean mind objects, and it's obviously described in much broader terms than that in the Satipatthana Sutta itself. The end result of the end of the day, I think dhammas here means something like principles or natural laws, right? So something like dhammas is the way the mind works, okay, in meditation. Something like that. Not so easy to translate skillfully into English. And particularly emphasizes the five hindrances on one hand, and then the seven awakening factors on the other hand, the good and the bad dhammas, okay, which are influencing the mind and creating positive and negative mind states. And again, without going into all the masses of detail around this and all the different versions, in the end of the day, I think that's probably the main emphasis on what's going on with dhammesu dhammanupassi. Viharati, one dwells, dwelling or living or abiding. Now, when this was said, Pesa, the elephant driver's son, said, "It is wonderful, Venerable Sir, it is marvellous how well the four foundations of mindfulness have been made known by the Blessed One, supanyatta, well Panyata, described. For the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana. Now, the interesting thing about this phrase is that Buddha hasn't up to this point mentioned that phrase, but it appears in the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta. So the suggestion, the textual suggestion here is that the layman who is answering the question is displaying his knowledge. He's already familiar with the four Satipatthanas, and he's acknowledging to the Buddha that, yes, you know, that these are well taught and so on. From time to time, Venerable Sir, we white-clothed lay people also abide with our minds well established in these four foundations of mindfulness. Interestingly, that it says, kālena kālang. A few interesting things about this. Kālena kālang, from time to time, literally. It's being instrumental and ablative. Instrumental and accusative forms of the same word, kālena kālang, implying that they're not practicing it all the time. They're practicing it sometimes, which is probably fairly realistic. This being just about, interestingly enough, almost the only place in the suttas where Satipatthana is actually said that lay people practice it. Of course, that's not to say they didn't, but it's the only place where it's explicitly said that they do. Except there's a couple of places in the Satipatthana Sanyutta where there are anagamis who are on their deathbed, okay, who are instructed to do Satipatthana. So if you imagine if you're a lay anagami and you're on your deathbed, obviously you've been given a fairly advanced practice, right? So it is interesting to notice that these days, you know, it's said so often that Satipatthana is a suitable practice for lay people, and yet in the suttas, when lay people are taught meditation, most of the time that they're taught the six recollections, and Brahma Viharas. These are the two ones that are taught very commonly for lay people. It is wonderful, Venerable Sir, it is marvellous how amid man's tangle, corruption and deceptions, the Blessed One knows the welfare and the harm of beings. Welfare and harm, hita, hitang, the hita and the ahita. I wonder whether that's what that means, actually. You have this idiom in Pali where this is hita, ahita, which looks like it's the positive and negative forms of the same word as Bhikkhu Bodhi's translated, but sometimes that kind of idiom actually means something like all kinds of benefits. So you have bhava bhave, doesn't mean existence and non-existence, it means all kinds of existence or any kind of existence. So that's another way of reading that, means it means all kinds of benefit, but I'm not sure about that. For humankind is a tangle, gahanang hetang bhante yaridang manusa. Okay, gahanang, a tangle. The animal is open enough, uttanakang hetang bhante yaridang pasavo. Venerable Sir, I can drive an elephant to be tamed, and in the time it takes to take a trip back and forth to Champa, that elephant will show every kind of deception, duplicity, crookedness, and fraud he is capable of. But those who are called our slaves, messengers, and servants behave in one way with the body, another way by speech, while still their minds work in still another way. It is wonderful, Venerable Sir, it is marvellous how amid man's tangled corruption and deceptions, the Blessed One knows the welfare and harm of beings, for humankind is a tangle, but the animal is open enough. Bhikkhu Bodhi's note on this, the point of this statement is that an animal's guile and trickery is very limited, while that of human beings is inexhaustible. So by the time you've got even just a short trip into Champa, the elephant's already got up to all of its tricks, doesn't have any more tricks, but the humans just keep coming up with more tricks for their whole lives. So it is, Pesa, so it is. Evmetang Pesa, Evmetang Pesa. Humankind is a tangle, but the animal is open enough. Pesa, there are four kinds of persons to be found existing in the world. Now, and the commentary here makes a note that this passage seems to come somewhat surprisingly in the context of the sutta, But according to the commentary, it's actually a sequel to Pessa's statement that the Blessed One knows the welfare and harm of beings. For the Buddha shows that the first three kinds of persons are practicing in harmful ways, while the fourth is practicing in a beneficial way. The passage can also be connected with Kandaraka's praise of the Sangha, for the Buddha will show three ways in which he does not train the Sangha, and the one way in which all the Buddhas of the past, present and future train their Sanghas. Four kinds of persons. Certain kind of person torments himself and pursues the practice of tormenting himself. Atan tapo hoti. Okay, so he tapas, torments, burns himself. Atta paritapana anu yogamanayutto. So this is the same phenomenon we noticed above with Satipatthana, that we have the verb form, past participle, anuyutto, devoted to the devotion. Okay, anu yoga. Literally, devoted to the devotion, or Ajahn Brahm likes to translate this as attached. He says that you should be attached to your meditation, anuyutta. Atta meaning self, paritapana. This is the root here is tap, as in tapas, to burn. It's used for the flame, the heat of the sun, among other things. And it's the same word as we have here, but here it's extended in both directions, so it looks a bit different. It's got a prefix in front of it, pari, meaning completely burning. And tapana is just a noun form, that's all. So that's just another, the na just makes it into a noun. So it doesn't really change the meaning. Atta paritapana nu yogamanayutto. Okay? Atta paritapana nu yogamanayutto. One is devoted to the devotion of self-torture. Something like that. Bhikkhubodhi Nona translated it better as a person pursues the practice of torturing himself. And a certain person tortures others. Parantapa, so para is always contrasted with atta. Atta, oneself. Para, others. Parantapo, one torments oneself and is devoted to the devotion of torturing of others. And a certain person is devoted to torturing himself and devoted to torturing others. And a certain person is torments oneself and others, and a certain person neither torments oneself, never, okay, na eva, na ta, neither torments oneself nor others. And neither tormenting oneself nor tormenting others, ditteva dhamme, and that means basically ditteva dhamme, ditta means visible, dhamma here means ditteva dhamme is an idiom, which one probably should not inquire too closely into the grammar of, but which means something like in this very life. Anicchato is free of desire or free of wishes. Nibbuto, he's gone out, like the flame's gone out. Sitibhuto, he's become cool. Sukhapatisangvedi, he experiences bliss. Brahmabhutena attana viharati. His self has become Brahma. So this kind of phrase is much beloved of those who would like to think that Buddhism is really just a variety of Hinduism. And they say here, the Buddha says that your self becomes Brahma. But of course, it's just an idiom, doesn't have any metaphysical implications here. It just means that you abide, you'll become holy. Brahma in this case means holy or purified. You would, of course, define the true Brahma as being one who's purified themselves. This, and of these four kinds of person, which satisfies your mind? Chittang arabheti. Okay, so the Buddha's asking him a question. The first three do not satisfy my mind, Venerable Sir, but the last one satisfies my mind. And actually in the text it gives them all in full. Why don't the first three satisfy your mind? Venerable, the one kind who torments himself and pursues the practice of tormenting himself, torments and tortures himself, though he desires pleasure and recoils from pain. Okay, so your nature is to seek for pleasure and to be happy, and yet we're torturing ourselves. Yeah? And so this is kind of weird. Sukha kama, seeking desirous of pleasure, dukkha pati kulang. Okay, recoils from pain. The kind who torments others and pursues the practice of tormenting others torments and tortures others who desire pleasure and recoil for pain. This is why this person does not satisfy my mind. The kind of person who torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself and tortures others, both of them desire pleasure and recoil from pain. But the one who neither torments oneself nor others abides hungerless, extinguished and cooled, and experiencing bliss, having himself become holy, he does not torment himself or others, both of whom desire pleasure and recoil for pain. So this is, I think, a very good answer, and really sort of cuts to the heart of the Dhamma here, is that the Dhamma is like a way of nature. It's not going against nature. It is our nature to want to be happy. And so there's this kind of idea that somehow by torturing ourselves, we're going to make ourselves happy. But this isn't the way of Dhamma. Okay, so then he said, "Now, Venerable Sir, we depart, we're busy. Bahukitta mayang bahukaraniya," thus proving that busyness isn't a mere invention of the modern world. Even in the past, they're too busy, got too much to do, to be able to listen to the Dhamma. Soon after he left, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus: "Bhikkhus, Pesa, the elephant driver's son, is wise. He has great wisdom. If he'd sat a little while longer until I had expounded for him in detail these four kinds of person, he would have greatly benefited. Still, he is greatly benefited even as it is." And then the monks, getting the hint, said, "This is the time, Blessed One, this is the time. Sugata Pandito, etasa bhagava kalo, etasa sugata kalo." This is the time to explain these four persons in detail. Having heard it from the Blessed One, the bhikkhus will remember it. Then bhikkhus, listen and attend closely to what I shall say. "Yes, Bhante," bhikkhus replied. The Blessed One said this. Now, what is the person who torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself? So this is similar to the passage in the Mahasachaka Sutta. Here a certain person goes naked, rejecting conventions, licking his hands, not coming when asked, not stopping when asked. He does not accept food, brought or food specially made, or an invitation to a meal. He receives nothing from a pot, from a bowl, across a threshold. So across the threshold means that if you're on alms round and someone's offering from inside the door of the house, then you're on the outside of the door, then you wouldn't receive any food. Across a stick, okay, across a pestle, like a mortar and pestle for pounding something. So if there's a pestle lying on the floor or something like that, then you wouldn't accept something which was given over that. I think the general idea is that if there's anything that... it seems to me like a magical thing. That in magical theory, often these kinds of things, like if there's something cutting across something, then that disturbs it. So for example, like if you're cross-legged, then that stops, like in the Roman Senate, for example, when they were discussing politics, they weren't allowed to sit cross-legged, because then you tie everything up in knots and nothing can proceed. Or if you want to really torment somebody, a mother, you go and sit where she's giving birth, and you go and sit outside and cross your legs, and that means you can't give birth until you've uncrossed your legs. So this is just one example. But there are many, many examples of these different kinds of magical beliefs, and it seems to me that often these kinds of things, which seem a bit irrational, are often derived from these kinds of magical beliefs. So that maybe the idea is that there's a kind of a connection between the offerer and the receiver, but if there's something that cuts across that, then that sort of cuts the connection somehow. But that might not have been understood in that way by those people, but it's a kind of a relic of that way of thinking. So these, of course, it's not explicitly identified with the Jains here, but it's very similar to the Jain practices. He won't eat except from two eating together, from a pregnant woman, from a woman giving suck, from a woman lying with a man, from where food is advertised to be distributed, from where a dog is waiting, from where flies are buzzing, so that means the whole of Australia. He accepts no fish or meat, accepts no liquor, wine or fermented brew. And so you notice this is a very characteristic of primitive thinking, is this kind of weird conjunction of kind of rational things. Well, he's an ascetic, he doesn't accept liquor and wine, so that's quite rational. But then these other things, which are like, you know, well, you can understand, you know, a woman lying with a man, okay, well, that's probably not very appropriate to accept dana in those circumstances. But then accepting nothing from a pot, why is it nothing from a pot? So this, and it's very, very characteristic. If you look at things like the Torah, and exactly the same kinds of things, you'll find very sensible prescriptions on cleanliness and so on, right next to jumbled up with all these kind of weird taboo kind of things, and no real way of distinguishing between them. He keeps to one house to one morsel, to two houses to two morsels, seven houses to seven morsels. He lives on... So think about it, right? All of those requirements that you've got to do, and then you've got to say, well, I'm only going to have from, you know, one house or something like that. So you have to sort of wander around until you do it. And one of the great examples of this kind of practice was Nyingatha Nataputta himself, who made this whole series of resolutions. I'm not going to eat until, and now I can't remember what all of them were. I don't know if you can remember.
Princess.
I accept food from someone who used to be a princess, who's
got a shaven head.
Got a shaven head.
Across the threshold.
Across the threshold.
Crying.
Crying. In chains, maybe?
In chains. Yeah.
In chains.
I don't know if there's any other.
And it has to be beans or something.
Yeah.
I might be able to find it here.
Such a person could go hungry in Bundaloon, I think.
There was once a beautiful princess named Vasumati. She was the daughter of King Dadiwahan and Queen Dharani of Champapuri, same place that our Sirdi is taught. Anyway, there's kind of old Jataka and stuff about her, but she ended up, there was a war broken out and the royal family ran away, and she got ended up getting sold off as a slave to a merchant called Ndanawa. So she was actually a slave, but she was a princess, but ended up as a slave. The merchant said, please treat her like our daughter. So the merchant was very kind to her, but the wife was suspicious about his intentions. And then the merchant came home from his shop one time. The servant who normally washed his feet was not there, so Chandanabala washed his feet. While she was washing his feet, her hair slipped out of the hairpin. The merchant saw this and put her hair, because her hands were dirty, so he put the hair back in the hairpin for her. And then the wife saw all this, and she thought, hang on, what's going on here? So when the merchant went away, the wife got a barber to cut off all of Chandanabala's beautiful hair and then tied her legs with heavy chains and locked her in a distant room apart from the main area of the house. She was kind of locked up and out of the way, so the merchant didn't know where she was. Finally he found her and was going to get a blacksmith to cut off the heavy chains and so on. And Chandanabala was amazed at how things were going, as one may well be in those circumstances. She started wondering how fate can change the life from rich to almost helpless. She then thought of offering lentils to somebody else before eating. Okay, so he gave her some dry lentils. She got up and walked to the door and stood there with one foot outside and one inside. Yeah, so one foot out and one foot out. To her surprise, she saw a monk who is Nyingatha Nataputta, Lord Mahavir, just before he was enlightened. She said, please come and accept this food. But Lord Mahavir had taken a vow to fast until a person who met certain conditions and offered him food. His conditions were, one, the person should be a princess. Two, she should be bald-headed. Three, she should be in chains. Four, she should offer uncooked lentils with one foot inside the house and the other outside. And five, she has to be crying. So he looked at her. She realized that, no, this isn't good enough. She only fulfills four of the five requirements because she's not crying. So he said, no, she doesn't count, right? So he's going to keep on fasting. He'd been fasting for months or something since then. No, he'd fasted for 5 months and 25 days already, okay? So then he said, no, not good enough. I'm going to have to find another princess with a bald head in chains, standing with one foot in and one foot out of the threshold, who's going to offer me dry lentils. And he went off. And when he did that, she was so upset that she cried. Tears came into her eyes. So he said, thank goodness for that. This is the Jain, and she later became the first Jain nun. Moving right along. Saucerfuls. And one food once a day to every 2 days, every 7 days, up to once a fortnight. He eats greens or millet or wild rice or hide parings or moss or rice bran or rice scum or sesame flour or grass or cow dung. He lives on... I'll have sesame flour, thank you very much. He lives on forest roots and fruits. He feeds on fallen fruits. He clothes himself in hemp mixed cloth, which would be something like the rice sacks that we use these days, in shrouds, in refuse rags, in tree bark, in antelope hide being the classic rishi's get-up in ancient India. Shiva usually wears an antelope hide. in kusa grass fabric, kusa being a very renowned prickly and scratchy grass, in bark fabric, in wood shavings fabric, in head hair wool. And the Buddha once declared that of all the kinds of garments which you can wear, the head hair wool garment is the worst. It's hot in the summer and cold in the winter and scratchy and uncomfortable. Animal wool, which doesn't sound too bad, and owl's wings. He is one who pulls out hair and beard, pursuing the practice of pulling out hair and beard, as the Jains again do. He one stands continuously, rejecting seats. He squats continuously, devoted to maintaining the squatting posture. He uses a mattress of spikes, of course, also a famous one, the nail bed. He dwells pursuing the practice of he bathing in water three times a day, including the evening. Begs me. That one. You can have the nail, the mattress of spikes, venerable Tapasi. I'll have three baths a day. Thus, in a variety of ways, he dwells pursuing the practice of tormenting and mortifying the body. This is the kind of person who torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself. Or else, for example, they will play soccer. Now, I just googled Hindu ascetics, okay? And they're all playing soccer. Now, who torments himself and torments others? Here a certain person is a butcher of sheep, of pigs, a fowler, a trapper of wild beasts, a hunter, a fisherman, a thief, or an executioner, a prison warden, or one who follows any such bloody occupation. Okay, who torments himself and others? Here a person is a head-anointed noble king or a well-to-do Brahmin. Having had a new sacrificial temple built to the east of the city, and having shaved off his hair and beard, dressing himself in rough hide, greasing his body with ghee and oil, scratching his back with a deer's horn, a curious detail, he enters the sacrificial temple together with his chief queen and his Brahmin high priest. There he lies down on the bare ground with the grass on it. The king lives on the milk and the first teat of a cow with a calf of the same colour, while the chief queen lives on the milk in the second teat, and the Brahmin high priest lives on the milk in the third teat. The milk in the fourth teat they pour onto the fire, and the calf lives on what is left. He says thus, let so many bulls be slaughtered for sacrifice, let so many bullocks be slaughtered for sacrifice, let so many heifers be slaughtered for sacrifice, let so many goats, sheep, trees be felled for the sacrificial posts. Let so much grass be cut for the sacrificial grass. Then his slave, messengers, and servants make preparations, weeping with tearful faces, being spurred on by threats of punishment and by fear. This is called the kind of person who torments himself and pursues the pack and torments others. So obviously people doing this kind of ritual. What this suggests to me, although it doesn't actually specifically say it, but it suggests maybe it's like a relic of the practice of the burial of the kings. So you know that in ancient times, certainly in ancient Egypt, it was very common, and ancient China, and many other places, the king would bury himself, or when they died, they'd be buried together with their wife or wives in the retinue and so on, and they'd all be kind of immolated. And the terracotta army, you bury that with you instead of burying the real soldiers. Not that difficult. You can persuade your wives and children and household residents, the eunuchs and things, to be buried with you, especially if you've got warriors to help you persuade them. But it's a bit difficult to persuade the warriors to come along as well. There's no one to persuade them. This was very archaic practice. So we're talking like the first dynasty in Egypt, so maybe 3000 BC, something like that. They used to do these kinds of things, and perhaps there was a relic of this kind of thing. We do know that in India, up until fairly recent times, there was practice, the ritual regicide was practiced, where the king would be either murdered or commit suicide as a ritual act on a periodical basis. And that was witnessed in the 16th century by European missionaries. And the king actually, on a platform, they did all the rituals, and the king actually proceeded to slice his own flesh off piece by piece. Slice his own flesh until he fainted and died from loss of blood. And so that was happening even just a few hundred years ago in India. This is a controversial thing in anthropology. James Fraser argued that that practice was basically a universal practice, or a stage in the development of human society, and that a lot of myths recollect and remember it. This is why I say that about this passage, because it strikes me as being an example of a memory of that thing, which maybe was remembered in ritual at that time. So even at that time, it was a distant memory. But it's disputed about how widespread it actually is. What kind of person bhikkhus does not torment himself or torment others? Here, a Tathagata appears in the world. Okay, so here he's going on to teach the whole of the gradual training. He declares this world with its gods, its maras and its brahmas, this generation with its recluses and brahmans and princes and people, which he has himself realized by direct knowledge. He teaches the dhamma good in the beginning, good in the middle and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, and he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. A householder or a householder's son or one born in some other clan hears that dhamma. On hearing the dhamma, he acquires faith in the Tathagata. Possessing that faith, he considers thus, household life is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. It is not easy while living in a home to leave the holy life utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. On a later occasion, abandoning a small or large fortune, abandoning a small or large circle of relatives, he shaves off his hair and beard, puts on the yellow robe, and goes forth from the home life into homelessness. Having thus gone forth and possessing the bhikkhu's training and way of life, abandoning the killing of living beings, he abstains from killing living beings. With rod and weapon laid aside, gentle and kindly, he abides compassionate to all living beings. Abandoning the taking of what is not given, he abstains from taking what is not given. Taking only what is given, expecting only what is given, by not stealing, he abides in purity. Abandoning in celibacy, he observes celibacy, living apart, abstaining from the vulgar practice of sexual intercourse. So this, of course, being the first three of the five precepts, and the third one being a brahmacharya. Then goes on to the four kinds of right speech. Abandoning false speech, he speaks truth, adheres to truth, is trustworthy and reliable, one who is no deceiver of the world. Abandoning malicious speech, he does not repeat elsewhere what he's heard here to divide these from those, nor does he repeat to these people what he's heard elsewhere to divide those from these. Thus he is one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendships, one who enjoys harmony, rejoices in harmony, delights in harmony, a speaker of words that promote harmony. Abandoning harsh speech, he abstains from harsh speech. He speaks such words as are gentle, pleasing to the ear, and lovable, as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by many, and agreeable to many. Abandoning gossip, he abstains from gossip. He speaks at the right time, speaks what is fact, speaks on what is good, speaks on the Dhamma and Vinaya. At the right time, he speaks such words as are worth recording, seasonable, moderate, and beneficial. He abstains from injuring plants and seeds. So there's the major precepts, and then moves on to the more minor precepts. Practice eating in one part of the day, abstains from dancing, singing, music, theatrical show, from wearing garlands, high and large couches, accepting gold and silver. So that being effectively up to the 10 precepts of the Samanera or Samaneri. He abstains from accepting raw grain and raw meat. He abstains from accepting women and girls. He abstains from accepting men and women slaves. This being somewhat controversial, it might seem fairly obvious to us that monks shouldn't have slaves, but actually it seems to have been fairly widespread in ancient times that they in fact did have slaves. He abstains from accepting goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephant, cattle, horses and mares, fields and lands, errands and running messengers. He abstains from buying and selling, from false weights, false metals and false measures, from cheating, deceiving, defrauding and trickery. He abstains from wounding, murdering, binding, brigandage, plunder, and violence. So this being the first, what they call the Chula Sila, the small section on Sila, which is found in this section of the gradual training. So the gradual training is set out in terms of Sila, Samadhi, Panya, ethics, concentration, wisdom, and found countless times throughout the suttas. The Digha Nikaya has the longest version and then goes on to explain those things in much more detail, but this being a relatively short version of the Silas. He becomes content with robes to protect his body and alms food to maintain his stomach, and wherever he goes, he sets out taking just these with him. Just as a bird, wherever it goes, flies with its wings as its only burden, so too the bhikkhu becomes content with robes to protect the body and with alms food to maintain the belly. Wherever he goes, he sets out taking only these with him. possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, experiences within him a bliss that is blameless. So this is very important. Of course, the teaching on contentment, and always something to bear in mind, and always when you're traveling, see what happens when you're traveling. How much stuff do you take with you? Do you have just your bowl and robes, or do you have lots of other things with you as well? Psychologically, you know, experiences the bliss, experiences the happiness. So this is not kind of torturing yourself, this is just being content. And because you're content, you're happy. On seeing a form with the eye, he does not grasp at its signs and features, since if he left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. So seeing, notice the same words, covetousness and grief, we met before in the context of Satipatthana. So he practices the way of its restraint, he guards the eye faculty. And same with the ear, nose, tongue, body and mind. So possessing this noble restraint of the faculties, he experiences within himself an unsullied bliss. He acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, when flexing and extending the limbs, when wearing the robes and carrying the outer robe and the bowl and the cup, and when eating, drinking, consuming food, tasting, when defecating and urinating, no need to demonstrate that one, and when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking and keeping silent. So this is that practice of what we call mindfulness in daily life. That's here as always an intrinsic part of the gradual training. Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, this noble restraint of the faculties, and this noble mindfulness and full awareness, he resorts to a secluded resting place. The forest we have here, root of a tree, plenty there, mountain, here we are, ravine, we have ravines, a hillside cave, we have hillside cave, charnel ground, here we have bones in here, a jungle thicket, open space, a heap of straw down by the compost. We have them all right? They're all here. This is one of the few places in the world where you've got all of those places together. On returning from his arms round after his meal, he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect and establishing mindfulness before him. Abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with a mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. Abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. Abandoning sloth and torpor, he's percipient of light, mindful and fully aware. And abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated with a mind inwardly peaceful. Abandoning doubt, he is unperplexed about wholesome dhammas and purifies his mind from doubt. Having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome dhammas, he enters and abides in the first jhana. So I should just backtrack a little bit here. Now I noted that the abhijja domanasa, covetousness and grief, is similar to the Satipatthana formula. So here it is, abhijja domanasa. The other thing which is also interesting is when he sits down to meditate. Those of you who have been here for a while have heard me go on about this many times, but anyway, here we go one more time. Sating upattapetva. Okay, so when we looked at Satipatthana, we noticed that it was the noun sati and the verb form upattapeti, okay, in its different forms. And here it's exactly the same thing, which doesn't come across so clearly in the translation, but actually all that means is you do Satipatthana. Okay, it's just a verbal resolution of the compound of Satipatthana. And then that leads to the abandoning of the hindrances and then the entering into the four jhanas. Okay, viviche vakamehi viviche kusalehi dhammehi savitakang savicharang vivekajang piti sukhang patamang jhanang upasampadya viharati. So quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome dhammas, with vitaka, putting the mind onto the object, with vichara, holding it there, sustaining it, vivekajang piti sukhang, the rapture, the born of seclusion, the rapture, the piti, the uplift, the sense of joy, and the sukha, the pervading pleasure and bliss of sukha, patamang jhanang upasampadya viharati, one enters and abides in the first jhana, vitaka vicharanang vupasama, so with this stilling of vitaka and vichara, so the mind not applying itself to the object anymore, not holding on the object, but just sitting there with it. Ajhatang sampasadanang, internally. Sampasada has two meanings here. One is confidence and the other is clarity. So we use the same idiom in English where we say, you know, are you clear about this? Yeah? And so that means you don't have doubts about it. Yeah? So it's the same thing, but it has that confidence and clarity that is just sitting there. Okay? It's not rippling with vitaka and vichara anymore. Ajatang sampasadanam. Chetaso eko dibhavang. Oneness of heart. Without vitaka and vichara, the samadhi jang, born of samadhi, so born of concentration, piti sukhang, the rapture and bliss, one enters and abides in the second jhana. So here, the rapture and bliss is born of samadhi rather than being born of seclusion. Okay? So the first jhana, what's emphasized is the seclusion from, of course, from karma and from akusala dhammas. So one, it's the innerness of it. One's cut myself off from the world and has come inside. With the second jhana, the emphasis is on the depth and solidity of the concentration. Okay, samadhi jhana piti sukham. Then with the fading away, pitiya, from piti, one abides in equanimity. So notice that these two words are paired, piti and upekha. When the piti ends, the rapture ends, one has upekha. So both of these are the emotional response to the pleasant feeling. Okay, so here with the piti, you're slightly excited by the object. Not kind of leaping up in the air, jumping up and down excited, but there's a slight ooh, right? There's a slight ooh about it, right? Whereas with the upekha, it's like that. Okay. So you still have the pleasant feeling, but your response to it has calmed down. Satocha sampajana, because of that, one is mindful and clearly comprehending, experiencing bliss with the body. Here, body, as I've explained in previous times, means basically, the kaya in this kind of idiom doesn't have anything to do with the physical body. What it means is, it means personally. It's talking about your immediate personal experience, okay? So it means that you're actually soaking in that experience. It's a pervasiveness of it which is being emphasized. Anamakaya is only mentioned in the context of dependent origination, and it's not explicitly mentioned in the context of developing samadhi. But in the context of developing samadhi, the way it uses kaya is like an idiom. It's not a defined meaning, but you even find it, say, in the arupa jhanas, okay? So they're formless attainments. So there's obviously no body or anything physical left there. Even cessation, it says kayena pasati. One touches with the body, touches cessation with the body. So there's obviously no body there. Mm-hmm. And they have this other idiom called the kaya sakhi, the body witness. And that's somebody who's like, it's like one of the classifications of arahants or anagamis, I think, who's really strongly developed their samadhi, yeah? And so that idea of the body witness, somebody who's personally witnessed that kind of thing. So I, this is my feeling, is that this is the implication. It's like an idiom, mm-hmm. rather than being a literal meaning here. Kayena patisangvedeti, that the Aryans announce one with equanimity and mindfulness dwells in bliss. Then with the abandoning of pleasure and the abandoning of pain and the previous mental pleasure and mental pain. So sukha here, in the fourth jhana, sukha and dukkha mean physical pain and pleasure. Previous mental pain and pleasure have all ended. So this is like reinforcing the ending of all kinds of pleasant and painful feelings, whatever kind. Adukhang, asukhang. It's saying the same thing again and again, repeating it again and again. They're all completely gone. And then one, upekha sati parisuddhihing, which means either one has purity. You can break this compound out another ways. You could say one has purity, mindfulness and equanimity, or you could say one has mindfulness purified by equanimity, or various kinds of way of breaking it up. Bhikkhupada translates it as purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. So this is one way of analysing the compound. From there, I won't go into detail with these, but from there he goes on to the three higher knowledges. First one, when his concentrated mind is purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to knowledge of the recollection of past lives. So one birth, two births and so on, up to 1,000 births, many eons of world contraction and expansion. There I had such and such a name, had such and such food, such was my span of life, and so on and so forth. Interestingly enough, when they do hypnotic regression of people to find out what they in their past lives, one of the things that they do tend to remember is what their food that they ate. And they did this one large-scale experiment, I think, with more than 1,000 kids in England. Almost all of them remembered in their past lives eating porridge, gruel, and hard bread, which is not the kind of thing that you would imagine children would make up. That was one of the very convincing details of that particular experiment. Then experiences the divine eye, and so the knowledge of the passing away and reappearing of beings. Okay, he understands how beings pass on according to their karma. Then, with the mind purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability. So this is the standard description of the mind in fourth jhana. Samahite chitte parisuddhe pariyodate anangane vigadupa kilese mudubhute kamaniye pite anenjapate. He understands as it actually is. This is dukkha. This is the origin of dukkha. This is the ending of dukkha. This is the way leading to the ending of dukkha. These are the asavas, the defilements. These is the origin of defilements. This is the ending of defilements and the way leading to the ending of defilements. When he knows and sees thus, his mind is liberated from the defilements of sensual desire, existence, and ignorance. When it's liberated, there comes the knowledge it is liberated. He understands birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. This bhikkhu is called the kind of person who does not torment himself or pursue the practice of torturing himself and does not torment others. The one who, since he torments neither himself nor others, is here and now hungerless, extinguished and cooled, and abides experiencing bliss, having himself become holy. This is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words.